fair. It's much taller. Podium is a little taller than I am. I'm sorry. Well, thank you very much. I'll try to make myself comfortable here. This shouldn't take too long. I'll try to make it as concise as possible. I'm very short. I talk very fast. So, should move. I'm going to have to do a lot of it by reading it, if you forgive me. It wouldn't be too long, I don't think. On the other hand, I do have a reputation for improvising. Some of you may have heard about that. If you haven't, some of you, I understand, even saw the films just by the sense of applause, maybe, maybe not, but you might know what to expect, I hope. What I'd like to know, actually, is what I'm doing here. I mean, usually I just like to find out what I'm doing anywhere, basically, you know. But today, I find myself actually very curious about just what it is a movie director is doing talking to a college graduating class. Can't hear you. Faster and louder. I'm going to leave the bigger general question to the experts and the critics, who are not necessarily the same people. So, although I'm not the ordinary choice, I guess, for an Ivy Day speaker, I'm very flattered to be here, actually. It makes a great change of pace, and whatever I've got to say, I figure I can make it at least as interesting as the average graduation speaker, like a senator, I guess, or a cabinet member, God knows what else. And when I got over being surprised and flattered by your invitation to come down here and talk, I started thinking about why you wanted me. Or did you? No, that's what I don't understand. Who didn't vote for me? I want to see him. Well, I figured it's because of what I am, like a movie director, quote unquote, and what I've done. So I made movies that have gotten to you in one way or another. Either you loved them or you hated them, or you moved you in one way or another, scared you, made you angry, all of those things, hopefully. That's the best. Also, I guess it's because the word famous comes up. Maybe infamous, and to a certain extent that may be true. And what really is interesting, however, is there's a certain amount of glamour connected with what I do. At least, what I do is usually seen as glamorous by people who aren't doing it, who don't have to go through the casual kind of nightmarish process of making a film themselves. And more about that later. But if I'm only a little sure what you expect from me, I don't have any idea what to expect from you. More than that, I don't really have any idea what you expect from movies, and that's one of the reasons I'm here, actually, to find out in a way. Not that I'll find out in an hour, but maybe eventually. Maybe the best way to start finding out is for me to pass along to you in the few minutes that we have here together some of the things I found out about movies in the past, or discovered, or learned from them. Some of you may think that you learned some things about me from watching the movie called Taxi Driver. I don't like to think about exactly what they are you thought you learned about me from that. But you must keep in mind that Taxi Driver was written by Paul Schrader. And it was inspired by Jean-Paul Sartre's Nausea, and which I never read. I never read any Sartre. And I have trouble reading. I'm sorry. No, it's true. I just had to buy a book called Nausea. Come on. I'm sure it's very good. It's also right there. Also inspired by Notes from Underground by Dostoevsky, which I did read and I do like. At the same time, the movie has nothing very much to do with me and a great deal to do with me in total. A lot of people who saw that movie didn't understand it at all. A lot of them saw it, obviously, for the wrong reasons, that is the blood and gore, the usual, the blood and gore. And I signed the film, it says directed by, and that means I believed in what I was doing in the film. If you had a certain thrill watching the blood and gore, if you did, well, that's part of it. Yeah. That's actually mainly the point. You try to find out what it is that thrills you inside, about those negative elements. It cuts right to the inside, and what's supposed to be the dark side of human beings, try to find out something about that. But to see the movie entirely for just those reasons, I think that's maybe the wrong idea. So I toned down the shooting sequence at the end of the film. I actually did. There's a rather ironic name for the process I used to do it. It's called bleeding out the color. So we bled the blood out by toning down the color in different shades. And I learned something about the movie that I made. I learned why some people were seeing it, and I learned what others were seeing in it, how they interpreted it, what they made of it. Every movie is like that for me. It's a lesson, a learning process, and a re-education. That may be why I have the impression talking to you today that we're sort of like travelers passing each other fast in a doorway. You know, you're graduating, you're going out, I'm going back in. In a sense, going back in because I'm about to make another picture. Start shooting in 2 weeks. On every movie I make, I relearn what learning is. The learning process actually never stops. And here, I'd like to say that this is what Roberto Rossellini was speaking about when he wrote in his essay on integral education, quote unquote, integral education. Maybe I just realized, I have a paragraph here that's written that says, you all know about Rossellini as a great director, et cetera, one of the very greatest, and all his movies I'm sure you know. I don't think you do know about his pictures. Maybe some of you don't. I mean, and the post-war period, there was Open City and Paisan. That led to the early 50s of films like Europa 51 and Voyage Through Italy. And then through 1970, late 60s, early 70s, with the historical films, The Rise of Louis XIV, up to The Age of the Medici, finishing with The Messiah, which eventually will be shown, I hope. But if you don't know about him, well, actually, he was not just, for me, a great filmmaker. He was, in a way, a great teacher. He taught not only by the example of his films, but through his writing. And I felt this is a good time and an excellent place to read you something he wrote. It was his last essay, and I think what he has to say can mean a lot to all of us. He wrote, quote, all the politicians and the moralists, the idealists who sincerely propose to carry out social changes must no longer overlook an essential factor. That is the conception and promotion of new forms of instruction, education, culture. Every radical change, as is well known, presupposes the development of new ways of thinking, new, quote, intellects, unquote, new, quote, values, unquote, new cultural models to be affixed to the traditional ones. For thousands of years now, in the succession of civilizations that have followed one another, many have suffered injustice and few have profited from them. But strangely enough, today, a profound feeling of dissatisfaction pervades us all. A great number of people, both among the oppressed and among the privileged classes, feel the need for a new and just society, and it's up to us to construct it. To achieve this, for our own health and for that of our society, we must finally promote an integral education. Through it, we must become able to eliminate all the false ideas, all the prejudices, all those things which draw us away from the truth. Things like the great mass of diseased pressures, of egoism, of vanity, of rivalry, of jealousy. We must have the courage to eliminate ambiguity, and so liberate ourselves from prejudices and fetishes. We must have the courage to face reality. Without an authentic cultural revolution, we will never be able to bring about radical changes in our social and economic concepts and in our way of life. And obviously, I've given all the heavy ideological weights. It's an unquote now. All the heavy ideological weights are usually hefted on graduation days. I've left up to Mr. Rossellini, and I'm quoting him so I can get out of it. Let me make the last point of Mr. Rossellini, what he's trying to say. In any case, he makes three general proposals. They go like this. Number one, education, as many consider it, must no longer be thought of in terms of a period of time of limited duration, introductory to life. It must be thought of as a component of life itself. The trade we really have to learn is the trade of man. And we can learn it throughout the whole course of our life, preparing and adapting ourselves to live, both us and the generations to follow us. Number two, the activities that, as it happens, each individual carries out within society, the trades, the professions, are not and must not represent the supreme end of our lives as we are pressed to consider them today in our society, which is based on obedience. They must be considered contingent and civil actions. One must count as the existence of man as such. And the third, we must make it so that from the first moment in our childhood, when the desire to know is felt, it should be well satisfied, and thus it will stay alive. He finally adds, we must no longer conceive education as a proposal of heroic edifying models. Every human being, if he is not harmed or confused or distorted, is in himself heroic and tends to be exemplary. We must take action by pushing ourselves tenaciously towards a collaborative human society. Starting from the obvious nature of small problems, we must be able to work up to the great causes, the historical ones, those which derive from our human, social, economic, political behavior. But it is useless to theorize. We must act. We must, at any rate, begin by helping ourselves to find an orientation, in a general sense, so as then to proceed to the development of new ways of thinking, always more rigorous, scientific, and hence always less, quote, emotional, unquote, less like the ones which dominate today. Little by little, as the culture models which we need to increase the use of our political, our potential intelligence are built up, the new values which will lead us towards a greater collective wisdom will be affirmed. And in a way, he says, education shouldn't be considered education, shouldn't even be called education, it should be called an introduction to knowledge. Now, I think those are very difficult precepts to define. They're even harder, I think, to live up to. Harder even than living up to the highest aesthetic standards Rossellini set for all of us. I think the achieving the clarity and simplicity of his movies, together with all the emotion and the intellectual ambition he put into them, is something I can only hope to achieve, the clarity and simplicity. It's a very hard thing. The simpler it gets, the harder it is. Hoping and trying, a little at a time, to find the clarity and the simplicity of a scene, of a detail, of a character, of a person. It's part of what I mentioned earlier as learning, the learning process each film involves, gets me involved with, the beginning of the new one especially. There's another question too. What can film be part of this, quote, integral education, quote, unquote, that Rossellini talks about? In his essay, he says that it can. Film can be part of it. I think it has to be part of it. It must be part of it. A film and all its new permutations, its cassettes and discs and, satellite stations and laser and the many, many things, even holograms, are tools that must be forged into weapons of our own spirit, or creative controls on our subconscious and our creative spirit. They have to work for us, really, not us for them. This is why, ultimately, I'm glad you saw the movie Taxi Driver. Here is part of your education, your formal education. Now, keep in mind the irony of that situation doesn't escape me. It troubles me a little bit, too, actually. It's more than ironic. It's really crazy, I think, that people are watching movies in a classroom. And my movies are anybody's, especially my movies. My movies are anybody's, actually. You have to go to a classroom to see my movies. It's very strange, very strange. I mean, for me, it really is. How could anybody dare to see a movie because they have to? It's very strange, because they're assigned to do it. And you'd have to be really crazy to do that, I think. I don't know. I'm assigned to see this movie. What? What a sign. Go see a movie. Enjoy it. And what you learn from it, you learn, if you need to. I went on to write here that I don't want Taxi Driver or any other movie of mine to become some kind of academic burden, actually. Imagine discussions in the future, people talking about God knows what, you know, being assigned The Wild Bunch. You know, the guy says, yeah, a great film. I personally love The Wild Bunch. The Wild Bunch by Sam Peckinpah. He says, that's nothing. I got Milton's Paradise Lost I have to do. Jesus, that's terrible, you know. Oh, God, I gotta watch The Wild Bunch 15 times. Oh, my God, you know. I mean, it's a burden. It shouldn't be a burden. The movies, when it's a different generation that are making films now. They were always very formative. They were always a very strong cultural force. A part of me thinks that maybe it was better when movies were a cultural force behind our backs, when we weren't aware of the influence they were having, only the impact. When I was a kid in New York, we'd all say to each other, you've got to see this picture, and we'd all go 3 times in 1 week to see the same movie, bring in new friends each time, enjoy it all over again, the same picture over and over again. Then later, when I was running around trying to get money to finish my first feature, and I started, quote, teaching, unquote, film. I taught people how to make movies practically, technically. Even then, that makes no sense, because the kind of equipment we had was very, very antiquated. The minute you taught them something about a lens, it was obsolete. Didn't matter. I taught them how to use the equipment, and I tried to encourage them to put down on film what they wanted to say, and what they honestly, personally wanted to say, not just the way I thought that they should say it. That's the only really important part of film school, that is getting to use the equipment. Especially if you come from a situation where you have no money to use equipment of your own, and you have no way of doing it. So the best use, make use of the equipment there. It's a matter of having, they said at one point, a philosophy. Somebody told me, he's now gone. He said, you have to have a philosophy. I didn't know what he meant. Had no idea what he meant. Very often I'd see my old professor, Haig Manoogian. A student would come up to him and say, I've got to direct. And Haig would say, well, you got a script? He said, no, I've got this terrific short story by Stephen Crane. I'm going to direct it, and it's going to be wonderful. He says, well, you have to write your own thing, and you have to direct it yourself. It has to come from you. You know, there's no such thing as somebody writing something and you're directing it and then somebody else editing it. It comes all from one person. And in a sense, that's why I always felt the best thing about the film schools, especially because there's so many today, the best thing about them is getting to use the equipment, getting to say what you want to say on film. The rest of the stuff, seeing the movies and learning the history of the movies is necessary, I guess, and maybe it's even fun at first, but you know, after a while, it just seems to turn into homework. And that's what I realized when I taught film school. I watch films become schoolwork, become studying. Films take on an academic onus, their homework, and it's like, in a way, being tortured. So it's like when I have to go and shoot Monday morning. So after a while, will anyone want to go to the movies for fun? That's one point. And movies were an escape for me and my friends and all the people who grew up the same time as I did. Little did we realize that they were shaping our ideas, our ambition, and dreams, and our philosophy. Again, behind our back, in a way. You get a glimmer of the impact of movies once in a while, and you'd say, my God, I'm being shaped by that, by Orson Welles and Lothar Mendes. Lothar Mendes is a Hungarian director who did a film called The Man Who Could Work Miracles in 1936, I believe, for Korda, Alexander Korda. John Ford and Joseph H. Lewis. John Ford, some of you may have heard of. Joseph H. Lewis directed Gun Crazy. Howard Hawks and Tay Garnett. And I said, and in a way you say, I'm being shaped by Hollywood. You know, this is disastrous. Well, it's not Hollywood exactly. It's more like certain aspects of Hollywood, or specifically, ideas that you see in Hollywood movies. That, more importantly, ideas. And in Hollywood movies, ideas are really characters. So I find myself drawn time and again to the character of the so-called anti-hero, for example. What they call an anti-hero, I don't quite know what that means. It's a type of character, evidently, that's often been associated with the movies I make, or all the movies I make, really, and I sort of think back about where that interest might have come from. For example, why do I like a film called Pete Kelly's Blues? It's directed by Jack Webb, the accident. If you ever get to see it, it's rarely shown, made in 1955. He's a very much of an anti-hero, very strange film, very odd. It took me a long time to realize that one of the reasons I love Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger's films, those the team that wrote the Red and directed and produced The Red Shoes, The Tales of Hoffman. Again, I'll be mentioning films that you may not have seen, some of you. A film called I Know Where I'm Going. It took me a long time to realize that one of the reasons why I love Michael Powell's films is because they deal with people who would be considered highly unsympathetic. Unsympathetic, that is, to most people in most situations. But you're drawn to these people. They get your sympathy or empathy because Michael Powell can make you understand them. And it's not a lesson. You don't go out saying, I understand that man because A, B, C, D, E. No, somehow something happens and you empathize or you sympathize. It's not a matter of sentimentalizing them either. That is, you don't have to have the character go over and feed a turtle or pet a dog. You know, he says, oh, he's good because he pets a dog. You know, that's so what? Yeah. But you really understand him in a deeper way, and you identify with them. He can show you why they are compelled to do what they have to do, and that makes them human, of course, that makes them like yourself then, right? You can follow me and then follow this process of fascination with the antihero all the way down the line, practically into the present. I mean, me meaning my films, through Mean Streets and Taxi Driver, down through New York, New York, and out again in Raging Bull. And that's what I mean, or part of what I mean anyhow, when I talk about being influenced by Hollywood. Not about the dreamy star culture of Hollywood, more like the icons and antiheroes of Hollywood. It's striking, too, that I can backtrack into my past and bring it to bear in one way that and think that I've understood something or satisfied myself that I've understood something. Then other people will see a movie I've made and understand it in a totally different way. That's rather shocking also. But maybe not for the reasons you'd think. It's shocking because that kind of understanding can be just as legitimate as my own, for my own reasons for making the picture. This happened with Raging Bull, especially in the recent case. I happened to travel from New York to Tokyo, wound up back in California somehow, I don't know, so I guess it was around the world with it. And from England and France to Italy and Japan with the film, and also with a lecture that we try to give on the preservation of video and film materials, and we try to get international support for it while we were there. In these many different places. But getting back to Raging Bull and the aspect of this sort of moving around with the film, I became very surprised because people everywhere would use certain key words when they described the film. I never met these people. And I never used the words in the film either. And, this is one of the reasons I'm here, because you have to take it or leave it. What I say about this picture, Raging Bull, what I'm going to say now is what I intended to put in it. But I didn't put it in a certain way. I didn't put it in, this is what this film means. I have no idea. It's something I felt that had to be. And yet, when we went around the world, there are people that I never met before who used certain key words that were not used in the film and certain scenes which wouldn't really reveal this sort of thing. In fact, I was very concerned about it, that it maybe be too much, it'd be too little, wouldn't reveal it. They would talk about the LaMotta character, Jake LaMotta's character, as redeeming himself. Right? For me, it was clear to me that they understood the picture then. Even without my having said anything to them about my own feelings and ideas about the movie. Some people would say very matter-of-factly, oh yes, in the scene in front of the mirror he redeems himself, and his salvation, of course, comes in the scene where he, you know. And I had never met these people. It was very strange. That was very good. Because I knew in a way that it had touched people the right way, the way I wanted it. Now, other people at the same time also say to me, why doesn't your film end with any hope? And in West Berlin, the commander-in-chief of the American Armed Forces, there was a cocktail party or something. We were there for the West Berlin opening of a film festival. I didn't want the film to be shown at a film festival because, I don't know, I just didn't want it. But we were there in West Berlin, and we found ourselves in this cocktail party, and this woman came over to me as we were leaving and said, I liked your film so much, but why is there no hope for the character? And I wanted to stay and talk to her, but I couldn't because they put us on some sort of strange schedule. I was never there before, and I didn't know what was happening. It was evidently extremely political. I had to go to the commander-in-chief, and then, I don't know, God knows. In any event, I said, I'd like to talk to you, but I can't. And as she was saying, why was there no hope for the character? She kept saying that. I was so interested in the film that finally, by the end, she said, there was no hope. And all I had time was to see that she was extremely distraught, and she had tears in her eyes when she was talking to me. And the whole question obviously disturbed her quite deeply. When I looked at her, when I saw how upset she was, I realized that, in a symbolic way, she was about to go into the jail scene, if you've seen the movie. She's about to go into the jail, see? Just about to go in, herself. She got locked up inside herself, and just completely the way Jake LaMotta is in the film, or the way I was when I made the picture, get put literally behind bars. It was one of those kind of terrible moments when you can read another person's situation more clearly, maybe, than they can themselves. And she couldn't see the redemption because she was in the same situation as Jake, about to face that test. So her point, where's the hope, where's the redemption, also became extremely valid. Very valid. There's just no way in which I could explain if there was any hope or redemption to her. She'd have to do it herself. I have to admit that if everybody saw one of my pictures exactly the same, if everybody saw one of my pictures exactly the same way, the same ideas, the same interpretation of it that I have, the same feelings, then I would know something was terribly wrong with the film. And you hope that people see what you're, you really hope that people see what you're trying to do and say in a certain way. But if they don't, you search for some validity in their reaction. That's part of, quote, integral education, unquote. The renewed education involved with making each movie and the relearning that each new film not only represents but initiates. And it really does initiate it, let me tell you. But you don't always realize this at the time you're making the movie, however. In Raging Bull, for example, from the scene in the jail, at the end, if you've seen the picture, to the very end of the film, at a certain point, I can do nothing but, as far as interpretation was concerned, just aim the camera the right way. Or what looked to be the right way, I guess. I could not really emphasize anything more. It was right there. I didn't have any other way to do it. I didn't see any other way to bring home any kind of point, the point of the redemption, the salvation that I saw. I really didn't have any other choice. I even eventually gave up on the idea of bringing home a point about what people might have come to call redemption or salvation. So that was completely out. I arrive at a place, and I don't know about other directors, but I suspect they may be the same, where you just say, the hell with it, and you fly, and worry about everything later. You take off, and you sort of go on co-pilot, and just hope you land at one place. And that's the only way you got to go through it, you know? It's what I call, in a way, kamikaze filmmaking. You knew that basically it means the end of your career, or the end of your life to a certain extent, but you felt that you had to do it. That's that. There's a sort of creative crisis point you reach and a crucial decision that has to be made. You have to let people accept your movie for what it is. That's it, and that's all. And if they accept your movie or your book or your painting or your poem or your speech or your talk or your looks for what it is, and they can see it on their own terms. It's your movie. Again, I'm using movie because I make movies. It's your movie, but it's their terms. And what those terms are, of course, depends on where each member of the audience happens to be in their own life. Maybe this is all rather fancy, roundabout way of arriving at the same point, a very simple point. And that is that there are no answers, none at all. Anybody with the answers, any answers, I'd like to hear from. You know, probably we'd all like to hear from them. There is no answer. There's only the process of finding the answers, I found. If there is any answer at all, it is the process itself. And that process is an inward matter. No matter how many little statues they give you, no matter how many little plaques, you know, all that stuff. Without that process, everyone comes up kind of empty, and I've seen it, believe me. Some of the best movies ever made are about that process. Again, Rossellini's Europa 51, made in 1950. Many of you probably haven't seen it. Most of you haven't seen it, maybe. It's a great movie, not only because it's about the process of finding an answer, but because at the end you think that Rossellini himself may have found almost an answer. You got a little glimpse, you know, a little peek behind the curtain. Just for a moment, you have the impression that Rossellini found one of the reasons that we're all here on Earth. Just one of the answers, maybe, just for a second. Maybe he forgot it as soon as he found out. Maybe he's a little blinded, you know, just forgot about it. But he had for a split second a kind of insight. He got it, and he held it, just for a second. Movies like Europa 51 and Voyage in Italy were very public films because of a scandal at that time between Mr. Rossellini and Ms. Bergman, who was his wife. But at the same time, they are shockingly personal, extremely private and personal at the same time. You feel almost by watching them that some intimacy has been violated. Movies like that are so profoundly private that you could almost say that they become selfish. And the selfishness of that creative act is the salvation of it. I mean, basically, when you die alone. I mean, even if a person dies next to you, they're not going to go through the same thing you're going through. How do you know? You're dying. You die alone. So, you know, it's up to you. It's up to you, you alone, to search out more about yourself. What you could call a spiritual and a moral sense, your soul, I guess, a soul. We all have to try to get over the idea, too, that searches like that should be popular or have to be popular. We have to wrestle down this idea of winning. The particularly American idea that going for the gold is the same thing as winning and as succeeding or breaking through. Many of Rossellini's films were never even shown in the United States. Europa 51 played in New York for 4 or 5 days, was never reviewed. And that was because of the scandal, I guess. But it was just never reviewed. It was finally shown last year at the New York Film Festival properly. The distributors, who have been a little desperate and certainly had ideas and definitions of success different from the ones we're talking about here, changed the film's title to No Greater Love. And it was not reviewed, as I said, and when it was reviewed anywhere, it was, of course, reviewed badly and did play only for about 4 to 5 days in New York. And it was a total disaster. But it's not the end of the story, because audiences have started to rediscover the film, as I said, in the New York Film Festival, for example, last year. They started to see, after nearly 30 years, that Mr. Rossellini's search for answers may not be so different from their own. So by any conventional measure that the movie business understands, Europa 51 was not a success. But we can't let ourselves be guided or influenced by such ideas of success. It is one of those, quote, false ideas, unquote, that Mr. Rossellini said draws us away from the truth. You have to fight for the freedom always to get closer to that truth. And I really have a feeling you're going to have to fight for that freedom very strongly to get closer to a truth. In whatever way you have to, and in one of the things, and in one of the things that you have to fight against is the idea of winning. This wild kind of crazy goal-oriented notion that wants you to think you've made it because you've broken through and you've become a success just because you've got some strange statuettes to kind of hang around, you know, and look at. That way of thinking really has to be changed. It's going to take a lot of doing, of course, and maybe it can't be done totally, you know, obviously. But stop and think for a second what the best-known single award in the world is. The award that has shaped everyone's ideas about winning. The award ceremony that has influenced not only the way everyone yearns to win awards, but also the way most awards are eventually presented. Some people will say, well, the Nobel Prize, the World Series trophy, I don't know. I don't even know what the World Series trophy looks like. I don't know. Indianapolis 500. Usually they come up with the Oscar. That the gold, now it's gold-plated. It used to be solid gold. The Oscar, usually they say that's in a funny way, in a glamorous way, the glamour that I was talking about before, the bad notion of glamour, an Oscar. You think of that. And in most everybody's fantasies, this is the ultimate win. It's kind of a fantasy. It's kind of nice. And I wonder if men who win the Nobel Peace Prize are a little disappointed, just a little, that when they show up in Stockholm to get it, they don't have a chance to wave it around for a television audience of 250 million people. Million people. And thank their wife and their mother and their agent, you know, managers, whatever, everybody who's gone through there, and I'd like to thank. You know, I wonder, I don't know. But I've got my suspicions, honestly, about it, because it is very much, the Oscar is behind very much the glamour, the point of glamour I was talking about before in Hollywood. The Hollywood glamour in the wrong way. The point is, in a way, that we've got to remember what matters to you and your own life, to continue on with Oscar, everyone's dream award, for just a moment more, with the Oscar. They're very good to have, Oscars, actually. You must face it. It's not just to fancy up any living room or to give your parents something to brag about. They are very good for business. This is a very, very basic economic fact. They're very good for business. In fact, actually, I wish I had won one. In that sense. I wish Raging Bull had won more that night, actually. I was very surprised it even got there in the first place. A movie wins an Oscar and it earns more money at the box office because more people come to see it, you see. It's not just Hollywood that believes in the Oscar. The more people who come to see a movie, the more money comes into the box office, and that money buys you, as a filmmaker, a kind of sense of freedom to make the next movie, or if you're lucky, the next couple of movies. Or unlucky, as the case might be. More or less just the way you want to make them, with nobody telling you how to make them. And that's the most important thing. And that's really all that's important. That money, in a sense, helps to pay your tuition. So you can keep making movies. And that is to keep learning more. Otherwise, such a win is empty. Such a victory is meaningless. I saw my 4-year-old daughter afterwards in after the Oscar show, and I asked her, did you see the Oscars? Did you see me on television? She says, yeah, it was boring. I said, yeah, I know. Hopefully not as boring as a speech, but I'll get over it in a minute. I said, yeah, it was boring. I said, well, what did you think? Well, I saw Bobby win. I said, yeah. Did you see Thelma win, who was my editor? She goes, oh, yes, yeah, yeah. And she said, and you saw me, yeah. She said, yeah, but you didn't win. No, we were there because I knew. Yeah. And we both were quiet for a second, and she's 4 years old, and she looked at me and said, what does winning mean? So, I really tried to explain. I couldn't. I mean, when you see there's five guys nominated, and then it doesn't make any sense. What does winning mean? I still don't have the. I don't have the answer. It's. I told her that it was all right, and that it it didn't really matter, and it was hard to tell what winning meant beyond just saying that maybe it could make you feel a little bit better for a little while, a very very little while. And but my 4 year old daughter and the millions of people who pay to see a movie because it has won an award, and for millions and millions more who watch the awards being handed out every year. All reliving, they all seem to be reliving their hopes and dreams and the defeats vicariously live from the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. They all are prisoners of a certain kind of ambition that they see mirrored in this yearly masquerade, which can be fun at some times. There may be a way, there just may be, to make a film that will cop the ultimate win, but you have to take a very big gamble. You have to be prepared for the consequences also. And the kind of gamble you take is based in calculation. It isn't based on any kind of truth. You know, I'm talking about truth. An honesty, I should say, maybe. It isn't based in the process of wanting to learn, the process of wanting to find an answer. It is the kind of gamble that can corrupt because it doesn't have anything to do with what's inside you. It's nothing to do with what's inside you at all. And if it does, it has nothing to do with the part of you that's best. That's the strongest. It has nothing to do with your soul. And that's the main thing, the main point to learn. It's that way with the business of movies and the art of movies, too. It's that way with every business. Everybody's in show business, everybody's a star. It's a song by the Kinks, it's another 60s group. Realizing I'm a little older here. But where do you stop? There's only so many stops you can make. What I mean by stop is, you know, where do you stop in this winning game, in this situation? Where do you stop? A stop doesn't mean just coming to a stop physically by stopping to walk. I mean, some people have to stop by dying or getting close to death. I stopped several times and the bad parts of my life. Elvis Presley stopped quite succinctly. And maybe that's lesson number one, day one, class one of integral education. You've got to learn where to start and how to stop. And for your own sake and safety, for your own soul, how to stop short, really stop short once in a while. Not to push yourself beyond the point where you've stopped three times and by the fourth time you can't come back. And the last point about Rossellini, his words, quote, education must no longer be thought of in terms of a period of time, but as a component of life itself. The trade we really have to learn is the trade of man, unquote. Now, if there's one thing I can tell you for sure, is that this is no easy situation. There are times you think you're going to be in school forever, and there are times when you get fed up or just bored, completely solid. For instance, right now, there's no particular enjoyment in the filmmaking process for me. Maybe a little bit when I'm editing, I enjoy that. But I really don't enjoy the filmmaking process at this point after having made Raging Bull. It's as almost as if we did it. I've had it. But when a director is actually shooting a film, when he's down there every day with the crew and the actors, it may all look very social and very exciting from the outside, and it is from the outside. Sometimes it gets to look a little that way from the inside, too. And maybe that's when you should watch out. It seemed very glamorous when we were doing New York, New York. Glamour went with that kind of film, a very strong musical fantasy, although it wasn't entirely fantasized. All the things that glamour takes in, that's what went with New York, New York. More money, a lot of prestige, a lot of expectation, scandal, everything that you can imagine glamour incorporating, that movie had. And when the movie came out, it lost its glamour in a big hurry because it wasn't the picture everybody expected to see. I was doing something else. I was making another kind of film. Certainly to my way of thinking, it was never even finished and probably shouldn't be finished. I took out 15 minutes, put 10 minutes back in, and, just forget it, work in progress, let it go. But all of us in that movie, to a certain extent, got sucked in by the outside perception of glamour. We became the victims of our own dreams. But it was a good learning process, or maybe a relearning process. And it was very difficult, and I almost died doing it, but it sure was a learning process. Integral education Very strong, integral education. I don't want you to get the idea either that while New York, New York was being made, I kept saying to myself, wow, what a great learning process. That doesn't happen that way. Now I'm going to go in and learn. Forget about it. Who wants to go to learn? I'd even say that on the last waltz, which balanced out the sort of chaotic situation New York, New York was involved with at that point, because I made the last waltz at the same time. The last waltz was a very strong lesson to me, but it was a lesson I didn't learn until afterwards. The entire movie, every song, for example, is preceded and followed by another song which influenced it. It was like a whole, it was like weaving an entire tapestry of popular music, the origins and the development of it. But I didn't know what I was really doing until it was after it was done, maybe a year after it was done. I didn't know I was learning. I didn't know I was really in the process of learning. And that's the best kind of learning. It's learning that lasts. And of course, learning to satisfy yourself, it's hard for anyone to satisfy themselves, and maybe especially hard for anyone who's doing something they think of as, quote, creative, unquote. The more you try, the tougher the struggle, because the struggle is so wearing. You become a little distanced from the actual process. The give and take on a movie set, the battle of egos that you hope to win every time out, which is, gets to be very boring. And if this sounds a little world-weary, a little jaded, well, that's good. And the best thing anyone can do about movies right now is to demystify the movie-making process. Making movies ought to be as casual and as natural as picking up a newspaper. That's why I put credits at the end of a film. Very long credits, they go on for 4 minutes sometimes. They're like luggage tags at an airport on your bags. And like luggage tags that say to people, quote, you want to see where this piece of luggage came from, or read this, this is a piece of me. And that's why the credits come on. It's almost like an ID tag. Jean Cocteau said somewhere at one point, quote, movies will never truly be an art form until the materials to make them become as simple and as accessible as a pencil and paper, unquote. Video will play a big step toward that. Another big step toward that big goal of having all the materials you make, what you want. Let me repeat that. And it will be, video would be another way of having that gigantic step toward the goal of having all the materials you want to be able to make them work for you, not for you to work for them, as I said before, so you don't have to rent them or go begging to a studio. In this case, my latest film is an independent film, totally independent, which means it's not tied to studios, which is extremely complicated and is very boring. But it's easy to get distracted along the way by other people, different goals. You're making a movie, and the producer says to you, hey, you've just asked for 100 extras. I can get you 250. And you say, well, why spend the money? Use dummies for the background. I mean, for example, A Raging Bull, if you look at The Ring, very often there were violent arguments between other members of the production by saying, well, if we pan the camera this way, it's 180 degrees, you need people back there. That's going to fill the lights. It's impossible. You have to have people back there. So I don't know, 100 people, basically. I don't want to spend the money on that. I mean, the camera's going to be flying this way. Who's going to see it, you know? And, you know, I said, "Get you can actually have cutouts and balloons on the heads, as for heads of people. You see, you could do that. They said they'd done it many times. And I said, sure, great. The only thing was that the dummies cost more than the people. Now, this is true. This is the inflation. The dummies cost more than, so we had to get the people. So we used the people. And it's totally mad. So, you know, you take the 250 people, which means you have to feed them, dress them, do a whole thing, and you become tangled up in kind of logistics and planning and decisions about dummies. I mean, it's totally insane. And it saps all your strength, and it keeps you further from that truth or that honesty that I was talking about, trying to stay simple and clear inside yourself. You want to get to the point where you say, quote, who cares how many people there are going to be? It's not important. They're all out there lost in the darkness anyway. And it's true. They were. Rossellini thought that the new technology of tapes and discs would make his vision of a world of integral education just a little closer to reality. And he was right. It's already bringing it much closer. In fact, as I said before, satellites in so many different ways, so many different things I've seen across around the world now, it is much closer. Your living room can be the best movie theater in the world. And with a video camera or a little Super 8 movie camera or even a Polaroid, I've taken over 3,000 Polaroids, and that's an actual film itself. You can make the material teach you. You utilize all those things to learn something about what's going on, to learn something about what you're doing and where you should be going. You have to give a lot of yourself, in any case, no matter what you're using. Whether it's a Polaroid or a pen, a videotape, or plaster, or paint, or anything, you still have to give a lot of yourself. And through learning yourself, you help other people see. Now, people can either learn the lessons or reject whatever's being said. That's their choice, but at least they can see. And in the case of my movies, I hope you can feel as well. and maybe pick up some sort of individual portrait of me. It may be made of information and misinformation, true and false impressions, but I hope it will be vivid. And if you're doing your job, if you learn your lessons well, then part of your portrait of me will be colored by shades of your own life, what you've experienced and what you've learned. The process of getting the goal, whether it's making the film or later understanding the film, is the best time you'll have. It's what I enjoy most to this point, this day. Setting a goal again, the joy and pain of reaching it or not, the learning and then the unlearning, that's the fun. You learn about religion and about politics and history, all refracted through your own consciousness, like a prism. Different colors. So when I finally get down to making the film, the movie becomes a kind of elaboration on what I've already learned, an integral elaboration. Therefore, an elaboration of integral education. So we're back at the sense that door back out there again. You're going on, I'm coming back in. I'm making a movie in a couple of weeks, a small picture, quote unquote, about a couple of comedians. Later on, I'm going to make a movie about street gangs in New York about 140 years ago, 1822 to 1865, draft riots, I guess. And a movie about early Christianity and things like that, as many as I can, I guess. So it looks like I'll be back in school for a while, and let me know what it's like on the outside. If you have any answers, don't forget to let me know. Thank you.